Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In 2014, British teenager Jessica Vine shaved her head and donated her hair to raise money for cancer research. Her charitable act was rewarded with an order not to come back to school without a wig. The story speaks to hair as commodity and symbol. Both strains are rooted far back in global culture. From Victorian mourning jewelry to religious sacrifice to fake weaves, hair is freighted with meaning and one of the most versatile and sought-after fibers in the world. The hair industry is now a billion-dollar global industry that you probably haven't heard much about, and those in the trade would like to keep it that way. Emma Tarlow is a professor of anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. Her book, Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair, follows her three-year trek across countries and continents in search of the global hair trade. Virginia spoke with her about her research.
So, billion-dollar industry. Where does most of this hair come from, and where does it go?
Well, a very large proportion of the hair is collected up in various sort of South and Southeast Asian countries, India, China, Myanmar, Vietnam, places like that. A lot of the hair then gets transported to China, which is the sort of biggest center in terms of factories for wigs and hair extensions. Some of it will get exported directly from countries like India to the United States, to Europe, and really every continent is buying hair.
You visited some of those factories where wigs are now manufactured in China, but it also turns out that China has been a kind of central source for hair and hair work since the early 1900s. What can you tell us about the origins there?
Yes, that was really interesting, actually, because I sort of rather assumed that this was a sort of contemporary global trade. But once I started doing the research, I realized that in Europe and America, we'd been importing hair from China, as you say, really actually from the late sort of 19th century onwards. And there was a big trade, particularly in the early 1900s, in hair nets made out of human hair. And these were hair nets that were incredibly popular in the United States and were worn by women during the day. And they were actually hand-knotted using sort of individual or sometimes double strands of hair. And they were usually made in China by women and children. So that's an old trade that goes back a very long way.
So how do today's systems work differently? You know, they're all mechanized and on a global scale moving around very quickly.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the work is actually still very much done by hand. You know, the sort of sorting out of strands of hair into the appropriate lengths, the tying it up and all those things that are done very much by hand, hackling it, which means sort of combing it on metal spikes. But some of the things have become mechanized, like they may have sort of ovens that with sort of self-timers for sort of baking curl into hair, or machine sewing machines, which are sort of triple-headed sewing machines, which are good for stitching hair wefts. So some of those things are done by machine. But there are still many factories and workshops where people are literally hand-knotting the wigs, you know, and the sort of custom-made high-end hair pieces are often hand-knotted individually, strand by strand, or two or three strands at a time.
I have to say, your book made me think about how this trade is going on that most people have no idea about. How did you stumble onto this?
Yes, oddly enough, I came into it through quite a strange angle, really. I'd been doing research about sort of hair covering practices amongst Muslims in Britain and around the world. And I was interested in how people are sort of trying to combine ideas of fashion and modesty and identity within head coverings. And whilst I was researching that in the sort of Islamic context, I became interested in how Orthodox Jewish women were also wearing hair coverings, but they were covering their hair with hair, so they were wearing wigs. So that sort of sparked my curiosity as to where the hair was coming from. And then I happened to stumble across this controversy that had taken place in 2004 when some Orthodox rabbis became very concerned that a lot of the hair that was coming into the Orthodox Jewish market was coming from Hindu temples in India, and they were concerned as to whether that hair was kosher or not. So once I started sort of becoming aware of those things, I became very fascinated, really, in that something so intimate and personal as hair that sort of grows on your own head could actually be sort of transiting around the world to such a great extent and become incorporated into people's lives, you know, in very, very different sort of cultural contexts.
Well, and in 2004, what you were speaking about, there was a burning, a mass burning of wigs of Orthodox Jewish women.
Yes, I mean, this particular rabbi who was based in Israel, a 94-year-old rabbi, much revered, basically declared that this hair wasn't kosher and that asked women to burn it because he felt that it was, you know, wrong for it to land up on somebody's head, even if it was given to charity. He was concerned that it might end up on a Jewish person's head and that this was inappropriate because he considered this Hindu form of worship a form of idol worship, and he felt it was inappropriate for Jewish women to be connected to that.
Well, this brings up a couple of different things. One is that the huge projections that we make upon hair, that yes. How one is supposed to look. And also going back to that China point and this rabbi's point, that hair is this strange way of mixing cultures, you know, women's hair from Southeast Asia ending up on the heads of women in Europe or in Israel.
Yes, and one of the fascinating things is there's a very big trade in combings, which is just hair that falls out during the combing and washing process. So that hair is being collected up sort of on doorsteps throughout Asia, and that gets sent to untangling workshops. And then it goes on to China to go to the wig factories and hair extension factories. But that means that sort of a single wig at the sort of lower end of the market may actually be containing the hair of really hundreds of different women, you know, even from different countries.
So they're not even shaving it off in this case, but using the combings, and there is a market for that. But there's a kind of fetishization that people collect hair on the side of the road. Part of it is economic, but what else is in there?
Well, I mean, in many cultures, there's the idea that hair that's come from your head is sort of dangerous in a way. It can be used for malpractice. It can be used for magic and so forth. So there are a lot of old customs of sort of burying hair or burning hair, sort of getting rid of waste hair. But because there is a market for it now, people are willing to sell it. And that sort of other side of it gets sort of downplayed. And then there's the religious context where people are willing to sort of renounce their hair as a sort of gesture of humility, or in the Hindu case, you know, in fulfillment of a vow they may have made to the gods in South India. And so there are various different contexts from which the hair emerges into the market that are very different, actually. I mean, the sort of religious donations are very, very different from someone selling hair for poverty or someone selling combings, which is really a form of recycling of what would otherwise go to waste.
I'm speaking with Emma Tarlow. She's a professor of anthropology and author of Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. She tracked it down all over the globe to find out more about the massive, and we're talking billion-dollar, global hair trade. Is some hair more valuable than others?
Yes. I mean, basically, a lot of the hair that's available on the market enters into the market black. I mean, it can be bleached and dyed, but it kind of loses value through the processing because it gets damaged to some extent. And therefore, if you can sort of obtain, you know, European blonde hair, which is sometimes known as virgin gold or auburn hair, you know, these are sort of more unusual colours that are difficult to get hold of. And if they are cut directly from the head rather than sort of mixed up combings, then these are the types of hair that are considerably more expensive than other hair. So it's called virgin hair if it hasn't been treated at all. And it's called remi hair if it's been cut in such a way that the cuticles are all still pointing from the scalp down to point, root to point, it's called in the industry. So if the hair is kept arranged in that way, it's a lot more valuable than if it's combings that have been mixed up, because those tangle a lot. And in order to get them untangled, after sorting them out into beautiful bunches, they then have to be sort of dipped in a kind of acid bath that removes the cuticle, and that weakens the hair. So that's considerably less valuable on the market.
So virgin gold, which has associations with blonde, which has associations with white. You travel to places like Senegal, where there is a brisk trade being done in hair that really looks white. There are so many associations between hair and race. In what you did, going all around the world, what did you find about that relationship between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because amongst many African-American women and amongst black women in Britain, there's you could say a natural hair movement. So there's some people are quite concerned to to appreciate natural hair fibre and not to sort of add, feel the need to add extra fibre. But on the other hand, there's a very lively ancient tradition of African hair arts in which, you know, fibre was often added. So there are different sort of histories that people draw on. And in terms of the marketing of hair, it's quite interesting the way in which sort of ethnic labels are sort of used to convey the idea of a certain sort of hair. So Brazilian hair or Peruvian hair or Indian hair, they all have a certain connotation, whereas Chinese hair is never really advertised as Chinese hair because there's this feeling that if it was advertised as Chinese, people might not buy it. They might not associate it with the right type of associations. They might associate it with being cheaply made in China or so on. So there's a lot of labelling which sort of plays on the idea of ethnic difference, even though the actual hair in the packets may actually be the same hair.
Well, we've been speaking mostly about the idea of wigs, and it is interesting because oftentimes, this sounds like a very female-centric supply and demand trade. You know, women are sort of producing the hair and buying it on the other end, though not exclusively. But they are not generally the people who are profiting from it. So who is?
Well, a lot of the big traders, it's true, are men. I wouldn't say men are, you know, men's participation as purchasers of hair is much more invisible than women's, because there are a lot of men buying hair pieces and getting custom-made hair pieces made up. And sometimes these are actually glued onto the scalp in such a way that you wouldn't have any idea that that person is wearing a hair piece. So I did come across situations where, you know, wives were not aware of their husbands actually having hair pieces, because the husbands would go on the quiet to have the thing taken off and sort of a new piece put on maybe every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks. And otherwise they were leading, you know, a normal life, swimming and showering and things without ever removing their hair. So there's a kind of invisible quality to the male side of buying hair covering.
The whole trade is sort of invisible on many levels. There's a certain kind of, I don't know, I'm going to say sordidness associated with it. I mean, why go to such lengths to keep this on the DL?
Well, it's interesting. It is a body part, and it's sort of both a body part and a sort of byproduct of the body. And I think we as humans are kind of nervous about the idea of and concerned about the idea of trading in sort of human parts. I mean, there's also a history of the Holocaust association that it may have for some people. But I think it's more than that. It's the fact that we sort of distinguish ourselves from animals in some ways. And we're quite happy to sort of trade in wool and animal hair. But human hair, it feels as if we're trading in something that's slightly, yes, almost slightly dodgy. But it's quite interesting for thinking, you know, about how we do make that distinction between animals and humans, because if you actually sort of boil it down to the fiber itself, it's sort of keratin in both cases, and there's very little difference really between human and animal hair.
And it is fascinating, some of the things you discover about the fiber and how it's used. Can you talk about one that was particularly surprising for you?
Yes, I mean, I was very surprised by the different uses that hair had been put. I mean, one was the use of sort of industrial filters for filtering oil in the seed crushing industry in the United States. And human hair filters had been very common up until the Second World War, when the sort of supply of hair from China was sort of cut off to some extent. I was also quite surprised, as I think many of the readers have also been surprised, by the fact that hair had been used for sort of extracting an amino acid called L-cysteine, which had been used quite extensively in the food processing industry. It adds elasticity to dough, so it had been used in things like pizza and bagels, and had also been used as a flavor enhancer. And that trade has officially been sort of banned, the use of sort of human hair derived products in food, but it may still be going on. It's difficult to trace. It's certainly still being used in sort of animal food and in some face and hair products.
Do you find yourself now walking around looking at people's hair differently?
I do, actually. I have to confess, I do read heads almost too much. I can't help it. And I also, if I see very beautiful hair, I can't help admiring it as well. I mean, I do notice it for sure.
And think, how much would that fetch on the market?
I haven't quite got around to sort of going around with my scissors and sort of chopping it off people's heads, you'll be pleased to hear.
That's really good.
Virginia Prescott there speaking with Emma Tarlow, author of Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. You'll find a link to read more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.